Peter was right. I feel like a judge. My name is Tom Needham. I'm an alcoholic. And God separated me from alcohol on October 15th, 1994. And His grace got me to that date. I was introduced to the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous back in 1974. Our third tradition talks about the only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. I had no desire, but my bride of 3 months had a very strong desire for me to have a desire to stop drinking. And she dragged me off into my first AA meeting. 3 months prior to that, we were married about 6 months at the time that I had my first meeting in AA. 3 months prior to that, she was the middle of the night, and in the United States, years ago, they had these public service announcements, and they may still have them time to time. I don't see much of them anymore. But they had this public service announcement for Al-Anon on TV. And it usually came like in the middle of the night when I guess they knew when untreated Al-Anons and untreated alcoholics were up, you know, and maybe tuning in. And she saw this public service announcement, and there was a picture of an alcoholic there that was in really bad shape. And the person that was doing the announcement says, you could see you know, like what the alcohol is doing to him, but can you see what it's doing to you, meaning my wife? And with that, my wife got the message of Al-Anon. And she ended up going in there, and she'll be celebrating someone 30 years in the Al-Anon family group. And for her, I'm very grateful. I'd like to say 3 months later, as I mentioned, you know, for me, my first meeting in Alcoholics Anonymous was I showed up. There was a pretty chunky guy came running up. I knew the man. It was out in Bay Ridge, which was, I would say about 3 or 4 miles away from where I did a lot of my drinking in another part of Brooklyn. And this man showed up, and he had a big smile on his face, and he was so happy to see me. And he called me by my nickname at the time, and he said, I'm so glad to see you. Now, mind you, I didn't want to be there. And I certainly didn't want him to solidify the fact that I should be there, especially with my wife on my arm. I was just trying to take the heat off a little bit, just take the heat off. I remember after that meeting, I don't remember much of it outside of that incident, and I caught my first resentment in Alcoholics Anonymous right there, I guess. And I came out of that meeting, the Old Bay Ridge group in Brooklyn, and I walked across to the street to this restaurant, and I was really shaky. I needed a drink, and my wife, I guess, you know, she needed to take the edge off too, although she's not alcoholic. But I convinced her of the fact that why not, you know, sit down, relax, don't worry about it. I don't have to drink, I told her. I was lying. I don't have to drink. And I remember her having some kind of a highball there, and I remember there was this Maraschino cherry on the top, and I knew it was, you know, just soaked with Irish whiskey, you know, and I was obsessed with the Manichino cherry, just so I can get something into my system. And I convinced her. I said, that's not going to bother me. So I grabbed the cherry and I ate it. And then she had to go to the woman's room, to the toilet, and she went. And by the time she got back, I had Old Faithful right there in front of me, three fingers of Johnny Walker Red with a splash. And that's how my drinking, I was a daily drinker. I was a functioning drunk. About 12, 13 years prior, I had my first drink of alcohol. And it was the first time that I have experienced that place that Peter was talking about, that place of ease and comfort. Prior to my ever picking up a drink, I suffered from this thing that we talk about and experience called the spiritual malady. I felt apart. I was brought up, like I think many of us were brought up, by people in this world and doing the best they can with what they have. And it was a situation where I always tried to overachieve. I don't know where that came from. I always had to look better and do better. And I did fairly well at that, you know, from early on in grammar school, from about the first to the seventh grade, I was on what they call in the honor roll, you know, so I always had a 90 average or above. I got heavily involved with sports. I was good at sports. My parents were kind enough to, you know, send me away, you know, like not to push me away, or maybe they had the ideas that they were pushing me away, but they gave me the opportunity that I could go to summer camp, and I went to a summer camp that was ran by the Salesian Brothers, which is an Italian Catholic order of brothers and priests, and with a friend of mine that was right around the corner and up the block, and we went together, and it's sort of like, you know, like I fell in love, you know. Years later, my friend Mark shared about, you know, maybe this is a second calling for you. But the first calling looked like this, that I had this man in my life. His name was Brother John Andre. God rest his soul. He just passed away about a couple of years ago. And I looked at this man, you know, and I wanted what he had, you know. He was a good man. He was, you know, like kind, you know, and it seemed like he liked to do what he was doing. And basically, it was just working with, you know, like boys, working with young men. And it was a lot of fun, a lot of sports, a lot of baseball and all of that. And I had ideas of becoming, you know, like a Salesian brother and perhaps maybe going on to the priesthood. I was already an altar boy, and from all outside appearances, I looked like a good kid. But I had this curiosity because I was living in Brooklyn, and it was a great neighborhood. Our neighborhood in Brooklyn had a lot of character. It was like 50% drunks, you know, and it was great, you know. I mean, and it was a mix of all types of nationalities. Ancestry that came to the United States, and it was a great place to grow up. But there were certain aspects of the neighborhood, and you had the gangs like South Brooklyn and Skid Row and a bunch of gangs that were just they were just breaking laws, and they were free, you know. And I looked at these people, you know, and I had, you know, like some sort of admiration, but at the same time, I had a little bit of a fear, you know, about what it was about, you know, to be, you know, a part of that. It came between the 7th and the 8th grade, and I ended up, we were out on summer recess, and my sister was going out with a guy by the name of, you know, like Paulie. His name is Slick, nickname was Slick, God rest his soul. He died from this disease. Slick had a friend by the name of Paulie, another man that made it into this fellowship, died from this disease. Went back out, couldn't stay. And we knew of Paulie, and Paulie, and you know, they, we knew we can go ahead and get it. We decided we were going to go ahead and experiment and get some booze, and we did that. And we got a bottle of a couple of pints of Southern Comfort, my friend Kenny, and he made me a bet that I couldn't take a water glass about this type of water glass and fill it up with Southern Comfort. It was about 100 proof, and take it down in one shot. And I was only about 13, but I took the challenge, and it went down, and it hurt. You know, that was the last time I did Southern Comfort. But it was good while it lasted, you know. Anyway, I don't remember a lot about what happened that day, with the exception of that I had that sensation, that place. I got to that place of ease and comfort, and all bets were off, and I was free. Whatever, you know, I had to do, or what I thought I had to do, all these belief systems that I didn't know they were belief systems at the time when I look back, you know, I was just free. Okay, I was stepping out easy, it seemed like, for the first time in my life. And I do remember my friend Kenny didn't want any part of it, of the drinking that we were doing. He had, you know, like a few shots. He got sick. I got sick too. But I had the other pint, and it was mine. It wasn't Kenny's, you know, only because he didn't. And I remember going home that night and actually being dropped off, laying down in front of my parents' door. I got picked up and thrown into bed, and I can remember the room spinning, and I can remember me going over to the side of the bed and vomiting and being deathly ill. Next thought that I had after coming out of all this the next day was, I got to do that again. I got to do that again. I got to get there again. Yeah. And something drastic happened. My whole life changed. We talked this morning about, you know, this life, you know, it takes on a new meaning. Well, my life that day took on a new meaning, you know. And everything went. Everything went. You know, I barely, you know, the next year was the 8th grade. It was the final year in this grammar school that I was going to. It was the 8th grade. I barely got out of that school with a 74.5 average. I wasn't, had no interest in becoming a Salesian brother anymore. because some women came into my life that year as well. I didn't think anymore about, you know, hanging out with the guys and playing sports. Now I was with the guys, Skid Row and South Brooklyn, the guys that I looked at. I had that certain curiosity about, and some harmful things you know, took place, beginning with my parents, you know, beginning with people, you know, that strangers that I didn't even know, you know. You know, this bias, this sickness in me, whatever it was, it just, you know, like, was a lot of anger. It just, you know, like, spewed out of me, and every opportunity that I had, I was drinking. And I made a Catholic high school because of tests the prior year before I ever picked up that drink. And I went to that Catholic high school for a period of 3 months, and they expelled me from that high school because they expelled me because a brother, was going to take a 2x4 piece of wood, and he was going to come after me with it, but I got to the piece of 2x4 first. And then it was just, you know, I can go into other things, but I'm really not going to get into any drama, but it just got progressively worse. Okay. I was a progressive drunk. I mean, the disease, it's a progressive disease. And I drank daily from, it seems, as soon as I got a job, as soon as I was able to get legally out of high school, and they kicked me out of that one school and they put me into a public high school, and it seems like the truant officer was more in my home than I was in school. And I was just always away. I was just, you know, like, never there. I was just out with the guys, you know, doing what we do, you know, steal, you know, and these weren't the values that I was brought up with. They weren't the values I was brought up with. And I caused a lot of harm and pain and agony to my parents, you know, and a lot of worry to aunts and uncles and everyone from the get-go. They had no idea what was going on with Tom. Good Tommy. What was going on with him? And I'll fast forward it to, as I mentioned, I did get married. I met this girl. I moved out of the house for the wrong reasons, and so did she. And we got married, and it was a very short period of time because she had this idea. This was my ex-wife, and she, this woman, and she was a beautiful girl. I don't know if anyone, but it was a situation where she had this idea that I should be coming home after work or something like this. In my neighborhood, it was that you get married, and then you just, you know, you go on with your lifestyle, you know, and that's, you know, that's where I was coming from. But she didn't appreciate the lifestyle, you know. And, well, I have to drink. So I joined the army to get away, you know. The draft was coming up, and I went into the army, and I went over to Vietnam, for the last 9 months that I was over in Vietnam, I didn't drink. I did something else called, I never touched, you know, marijuana, and this was about 1967 at the time, 1968 when I ended up over there in Vietnam, and I never touched grass, but they had these things over there that they, as I recall, they called them Luke Maus, and they were about this long and about that round, about the size of a mini cigar, and they were Vietnamese grass, and it was laced with pure black liquid opium. So if you don't want to drink, that's a good idea. You can go ahead and try something like that. You won't drink. You don't have to drink, you know. So I didn't. I came back from Vietnam, and I was experiencing some restlessness, irritability, and discontentment because I didn't have that stuff that I had over there back here in the States. And I was trying all types of different things. And I only mention this is because this is part of my story. And I have to tell you, I'm for a lot of years in Alcoholics Anonymous, I would raise my hand and I would say, my name is Tom. I'm an alcoholic. I'm an addict. I'm a compulsive gambler. And I found my truth, thank God, you know, around 9 years ago when I went through this process as it's outlined in our basic text. And I found out I'm just a real alcoholic. I'm not an addict. I walked away from it. I saw that by going back into it. And I'm not a compulsive gambler. I joke about it, but this is on tape. My wife will get a little perturbed. Sometimes I have to grab her away from the slot machines down Atlantic City and say, let's go see a show. But it's a good life today. Getting back to where I was, I came back from Vietnam. And I tried to get to that place, that state of mind that I was over in Vietnam. And I was experimenting all kinds of stuff. It ended up the closest thing I could come to it was, you know, I'd have my Johnny Walker Red that I gravitated to, like three fingers, Johnny Walker Red, splash and a twist, and throw about $20 worth of crystal meth and just dunk that right in and stir it around and try to get to that place, you know. See, I didn't understand, you know. I thought, you know, people were telling me alcohol was a depressant, you know. And then, you know, you have speed over here, so I figured if I got to that place, you know, maybe I'd get somewhere in the middle. But not for this alcoholic, you know. I found out later on something about this thing called the phenomenon of craving. And it's been my experience that any time that I ingested alcohol into my system, I really, you know, people talk about control or trying to control. I didn't have too much experience with trying to control my drinking. I guess that's the mental aspect of it, but as far as my body, I have to agree with my friend Don. You know, once alcohol went into my system, it just said more, period. It just said more. And I came back from, like Vietnam, trying to move along here, and I got divorced. I didn't get divorced. I didn't even know I was divorced. You know, the court papers, I understand, said I abandoned her, you know. And I was nowhere to be found, you know. Nobody knew where I was. Not too many people were looking for me either, I'm sure. I ended up taking a few geographics. I ended up out in Chicago. We talk about these things. I don't know what's going to happen when I pick up a drink. As I mentioned, I ended up in Chicago, and my mom called, and my dad was dying. He had cancer. And I came back, and we buried my dad. And that was another good excuse to go back out in Chicago and go on a real bad tear, you know, which I did. Because we never really had, you know, like a close relationship, and I had a lot of remorse over that and a lot of anger at myself. But then again, after a few months, after my dad passed away, my mom called me again, and she wanted to come on back, me to come back, and try to help her. And I intended to try to do the right thing, Tom. Go back. You know? And I tried going back. I picked up a drink in Chicago, and I don't know what happened, but 3 days later, I didn't have the money that I started out with, which was only about $1,500, and this was like in the early 70s. And I was down in a motel on Airline Highway next to a woman that I didn't even know when I woke up. And I'm down in New Orleans now. Chicago is in the Midwest. Brooklyn, where I'm heading, is east. And New Orleans is on the Gulf of Mexico. And that's where I ended up. So I don't know what happens to me when I pick up a drink. And I drove. And I don't remember. I ended up coming back into Brooklyn. My mom had enough of me. She left. I was living in my parents' apartments there. They were vacated by my mom. And she went up to the Upper Peninsula of Michigan to live with my sister. I made that apartment a Bowery. I had the guys from the wine gang in there, me included. It was a mess. I was in no shape to work. I sold everything that I could of my parents. The only thing that I left was the TV. It was like my only connection to sanity, I thought. I remember one day, I was sharing about this last night, I remember one day I was in my home, ran out of food, as if I really cared whether there was food or not, but I guess I must have sensed a little bit of hunger in my gut, because I didn't eat very much. But I remember going into the cupboard out in the kitchen, and there was the only thing I can find all the way in the back in the corner of the cabinet was a small jar of Gerber baby food. And I remember sitting in front of the TV and had that baby food open and my legs crossed and I'm looking at myself. And that was the little bit of a bottom for me. Finally. And I said to myself, I'm never going to get to this place again. And no one was allowed to come into my house anymore. Okay? And I'm going to pull myself up by my bootstraps, and I'm going to go ahead, and I'm going to make a life for myself. I didn't realize alcohol had other plans. I had no idea. I went down to Bush Tunnel, which was a long walk, and that's where I met my bride of today, Jenny, in a place on a Gray Ark printing place, and it was like I was an expediter. I would give the plates for the people that needed to print the different things that we were printing. And I was only making $100 a week, and which is interesting because out in Chicago, I was making like $600 a week in the early 70s, which was a lot of money because I had a part-time job as a bartender out there, which was good. That helped me supplement my alcohol consumption. And I ended up meeting my bride, like I mentioned, and we had a couple of, like a 1.5 year relationship, I think it was in 72 that we met. And I put this woman through hell. And she stayed with me because she was already affected by alcoholism with her father and others in her family and her uncles. So I was perfect. I guess I came along and her eyes lit up and, I don't know. But we started this bumpy road together and it was bumpy. And there was a lot of, we had some real, I was not a nice person. And if you heard interfere or threaten with my alcoholism, my alcohol, any way that I'm going to get to it, we got a real problem. And I did some things that I'm not proud of. So it brings us back, to that first meeting that she brought me to, and I'll just fast forward about 3 years, because by this time Jeannie was in the Al-Anon fellowship for that length of time, And people were showing up in our home, and all her friends, I used to call them the Sisters of Perpetual Revenge, you know, and Sisters of Death. You know, they're all talking about me. They're all out to get me. And I'd come home drunk, you know. And something happened. Thank God she made it there. Because I made a decision. I made a decision that I was going to stop drinking. But I didn't need any of this stuff, Alcoholics Anonymous, and I didn't need any help from her. I was going to do like my dad did, which he did. He took the pledge. I don't think he ever went to Alcoholics Anonymous. He got sober in 1954, and he passed away in 1972. And he went up to the church. He got the pledge. I think he tried a few times to get the pledge, but he did. But I experienced, you know, like, well, I won't even, you know, I go there with, that's my dad's story, you know, and but for me, I made that decision. I was going to go ahead and I was going to go cold turkey. And it wasn't, I don't think I lasted maybe about 24, 36 hours. And I turned and I asked Jenny if I could get some help. Because I started to experience these things that aren't too pretty. You know, I remember going into the bathroom and, you know, having dry heaves and shaking off my arm, and I thought there were roaches on it, and my skin was crawling, and then I'd walk outside, you know, I'm sitting on the couch, then I start to see a couple of rodents going around the baseboard of the house, and I'm telling Ginny that we have rats, and Ginny's looking at me kind of funny, and can't find any holes where the rats went, underneath the radiator. So a guy by the name of Al shows up with the guy, this man Al, and a guy Paul the mailman, and they showed up, and thank God for Alcoholics Anonymous. These men. They carried a message. And it wasn't the message that I guess. It was the message, the men, their spirit they carried. And they stayed with me for about a good 24 hours, I would think, on and off. They were taking shifts. So the seed of Alcoholics Anonymous was planted. And they tried to, that was sometime in, I think, in October of 77. And they tried to, you know, like, take me to meetings. And I remember the first meeting that I, you know, like, was there, and a guy mentioned to me at the meeting, he says, look, and I still, you know, like, I was still drinking, you know, and I had, you know, some I had a half a load on when I showed up at that, you know, like, meeting. And a man approached me. He says, look, as long as you don't disrupt the meeting, we don't care if you come in and you got a half a load. You know, just keep on coming back. You just can't disrupt the meetings. So I took this guy to heart. I showed up with a flask every Tuesday and Friday night, you know, and I'd slip into the bathroom, you know. I had no idea. I mean, there were some nights you know, I recall I actually made some comments at step meetings, you know, and I got a half a load on it. Who knew? March of 78 showed up, and I hit another bottom. And it happened across the street from the 72 precinct on 4th Avenue in Brooklyn. And I was sitting down in this restaurant over there, and I was coming off a three-day drunk. And at the time, we had two little girls, you know, Janine and Jennifer. And I was seriously considering about taking myself off the planet. They don't need me. Realize that I'm never going to get it. Now, this time, by this time, like I said, I'm October 77 in March, you know, I got about 5 or 6 months bouncing in and out of Alcoholics Anonymous and showing up. But I'll tell you what was happening. What was happening, I was going to those meetings and I was getting honest with myself in spite of myself. You know, I was starting to identify, you know, like with these people, what they were talking about. I was a little hazy because in the shape I was that I was going to the meetings, but I guess I wasn't too different from Bill, you know, because Bill sat down and he got the message when he had a half a load on as well. And but the reason I say my drinking was getting progressively worse, you know, like a head full of AA and a belly full of whiskey doesn't work, you know. And it was getting bad, you know, because now I couldn't even experience that place of ease and comfort. Alcohol was stopping, it was starting to stop working for me. And the way I would like it to work for me, because I was starting to face the truth about me, and I didn't like that. I didn't like that at all. And now I wasn't drinking, you know, for that place of ease and comfort. Now I was drinking just not to, even to look at me, so I just drank to go into oblivion. 78 showed up, and that day when I was seriously considering, you know, like taking myself off the planet, I'm a coward, you know, and I couldn't figure out how I was going to go about it. And I ended up walking back to the old Sunset Group in Brooklyn. And a man showed up in my life there, a guy by the name of Johnny Walsh. God rest his soul. Another man. I mean, this guy looked like a drunk. This guy. Johnny was a great guy. You know? And it's old-time AA, you know, and in Brooklyn. I don't mean, you know, it was old-time to me back in the 70s there. And I did what you people told me to do, and I went to 90 meetings in 90 days. You know, I did a lot more than that. I went to 2 meetings every weekday, and I went to 3 meetings every weekend day. And I did that for about 2 or 3 years straight. And I was, I'll tell you, I remember vividly when I had about 3 months, and I was walking out of my house in Brooklyn, and I was going up to the, about 4 blocks away to what we call the corner group clubhouse. And I remember walking out of the house and up the block, and I had a sense of dignity about me, that the cops weren't around for a period of about 3 months, you know, on my block. Because the cops showed up once ever so often, paid me a visit, and that wasn't happening. And I was able to hold my head up a little bit. But all, like I said, the next 2 or 3 years, I'm just doing. I'm active in service. I'm active in this. I'm going to step meetings. I can't, you know, I'm trying to do the steps off the wall. My friend Don says you do the steps off the wall, you get off the wall sobriety. You know, and makes sense. I had no idea. I had no idea what I was doing in terms of the fellowship. And really what I was doing was, I later found out, you know, we have 3 sides to our triangle. And I was practicing one side of the triangle, expecting the other 2 just to show up through osmosis or something, you know. You know, there's no chapter in our book saying into osmosis, you know. It says into action. There's no chapter into thinking either. So I did that, and after a period of time, I'm going to meetings, and I for some reason I know there's more to this, and I don't understand, and a guy like me, you know, I'm not going to ask for help. I never did ask for help. I'll figure this out myself. Take a sick mind and try to fix a sick mind. But I wouldn't. I wouldn't raise my hand. And every once in a while, I would get a spark of a message from guys like Jimmy L in Brooklyn and Jimmy G from another part of Brooklyn, and I'd be getting messages, glimpses of it, you know. But I wouldn't be able to go ahead and approach them, you know, because like I said, I could do this. I don't need anybody's help. So that fear stopped me, or that pride stopped me, you know, from like approaching these people and asking, "What are you doing?" I could tell you what happened during the next 7 or 8 years. It was nuts. Okay, I didn't spend very much time at home. During that time in early sobriety, we were blessed with my son, Tommy. He came into our life, but I was never home. I was never home. Okay, it was all about me and what I needed to do. I didn't get the message, the real message of Alcoholics Anonymous. It wasn't sinking in, and I wasn't letting anybody show it to me, obviously, either. So the end result of that is that I started to get involved in other things, gambling. Okay, I figured if I go down to the gambling table at the blackjack or craps, you know, the action, the juice, you know, we got that empty hole, and that'll fill that up. Okay, and that worked for a little while. Cost a lot of money. I thought maybe my having my own business and climbing up a corporate ladder and making a lot of money, you know, that would do it, you know. So I would spend 14, 16 hours away from my home again, you know. Then other things came into my life. The end result was that I was sharing about how a guy like me, and I mentioned I think last night, you know, my favorite song was Billy Joel, you know, and I think he was the guy that put out that song, An Angry Young Man. You know, I sort of identified with the song, you know, I remember going over the Outer Bridge Crossing once, which is a bridge from New Jersey into Staten Island in the New York area. It's only a two-lane bridge, you know. And I remember someone cutting me off. And I sideswiped the guy with a brand-new Lincoln Town Car that I just bought about a few weeks earlier. And I was waiting at the bottom of the bridge, and I had a bat in the back seat, and I was ready to go, you know, sober. This was about 7 or 8 years sober again. So something was wrong, and I was parked in my car on the Upper East Side of Manhattan one day in 1987. And that morning I had no thought of drinking, or so it seemed. And I got out of my car and I walked into a deli or a bodega that you may have over here. And I got two quarts. You know, mental blank spot. Or the lie to myself, if I even thought. My mind was scrambled. It was a wreck. And that was the beginning of another 7 year debacle with alcohol. By the end of that week, I may have tried to control it. I can't tell you for sure, But that was for a good 1 week, I would think. And by the end of that week, I know I was up to something like a case of beer and maybe a half a quart of Johnny Walker Red daily, and it sort of progressed from there. You know, because I suffer from this thing called the phenomenon of craving. My body says more eventually. I tried coming back to Alcoholics Anonymous. And my lens of sobriety, and it was bare white knuckle sobriety. And I was slipping back and forth, and it was getting progressively worse and worse and worse and worse. And the jails were there and all over again, and the cops and the drama and the harm, you know that I caused my wife and my children, and anyone that I really came in contact with for any period of time. I remember a meeting in a group in Brooklyn about 3 months before I showed up. And someone carried this message to me as it's outlined in our book. And in this meeting, I was angry. It was progressing to the point, and they talk about it, meeting makers make it. I was going to about 4 or 5 meetings a week. I really had a desire. I didn't want to go through this anymore. I was tired, you know, and it was killing. I knew what was happening, and I just didn't want to do it, and I didn't think I was going to make it. And a lot of other people in Alcoholics Anonymous thought I wasn't going to make it either. Because I think there was some disgust for a guy like me that would be walking in and out, and in and out, and can't get it. But I remember at this one meeting, there was a guy, for me, it came around my turn. And I, again, as usual, you know, like I had a few in me. And I took my fist and I put it down to the table. And I just told the people, I says, you know, all I'm doing here is putting a Band-Aid on this thing. And that Band-Aid is going to peel off by the time I get out that door, because I will drink. I will drink. And after that meeting, this guy comes up to me and he says, Tom, what are you so angry about? And then he said a classic, I almost killed this guy. He says, you know what to do. You know what to do. You did it. You were sober nearly 10 years. You know what to do. I mean, if I knew what to do, wouldn't I be doing it? I mean, I'm not showing up here for my health. Well, I am showing up there for my help. I'm not getting any help. You know, it's shortly after that, I found myself in a jail cell. You know, getting taken out of my home by handcuffs and my daughter. The scene is no different from the scenes that took place before, and all the pain that I caused other people and my family before, you know. The pain intensified, I'm sure, to them. But I remember my daughter crying and yelling, and my son sad, and I'm being taken away. And I'm in a jail cell. And in that jail cell, I'm facing some time, you know, 6 months, perhaps a year, at a place called Rikers Island. And which isn't a very nice place, especially for a guy that's 46 years of age, you know, can't make it up there. And I remember being in the jail cell, and I reached in my pocket, and there was a little card. I don't know if you have them over here in Denmark, but or in Scandinavia, they had a little Just for Today card. And to me, that card symbolized Alcoholics Anonymous. And I saw some truth in that jail cell that day. I took that card, and I just, out of disgust, I threw it to the corner of the jail cell. I just threw it, because that symbolized Alcoholics Anonymous. Albeit it symbolized Alcoholics Anonymous as I perceived it. And the way I perceived it, now that I think back, is that Alcoholics Anonymous was just a group of drunks. And it says somewhere in the ABC that probably no human power could relieve me of my alcoholism. And believe me when I tell you, I really tried to find God during that long stint in Alcoholics Anonymous. And maybe even during me bouncing back and forth for the next 7 years after I drank again. I really tried. And I couldn't find God. The problem was, is I was looking for God out here. My book tells me he can be found deep down within. That's a promise. But that's where I was on that day in that jail cell. And I threw that card into the corner of the jail cell. And with that, it seemed like almost at that moment, a sense of hopelessness came over me. Really bad. You know, they talk about in a vision for you about the four horsemen, and they showed up. They showed up in that jail cell for me that day. And I was just driven to my knees. And it was a cry for help. I don't know what the prayer was. There's a guy by the name of Clint. I heard him on a tape one time, and his prayer was, when he got to that place, would God come? Come now, don't even send your son, because this is no place for children. I identified with the desperation of that prayer, you know. I identified with that prayer. That resonated strongly in me, because that's where I was at. And what happened was, he showed up. He was always there. I guess it was just a matter of me crying out for help. He showed up. And some work was being done behind the scenes, because I didn't see it. And my wife, Jenny, she was at an Al-Anon meeting that night. And I don't know what she was sharing, but I'm sure she was not happy with me. 20 years in and out. She was pretty well done. And there was a woman at that meeting that was in AA and Al-Anon. And this woman was listening to my wife, obviously, and then she tried to track my wife down. Because this woman just went through the steps as outlined in the big book, Alcoholics Anonymous, and she was on fire. My wife didn't want any part of it, but she got the number after about a half hour anyway. She forced it on her. And this woman was picking up, I got out of jail. The judge cut me a break. He put me on alcoholism treatment for outpatient alcoholism treatments, where you go for therapists so they can tell you how to have the power to fix you. human power. Ended up, I was driven home by my wife, and my two girls were in the back of the car, and I came home, and my wife was being taken to a meeting by that same lady that day, to an Al-Anon meeting. And when that lady showed up, she wanted to know if I got the card, if I got the telephone number. She gave her a telephone number of a guy that was on Staten Island, a man by the name of Larry G. And I got on the phone. Like I said, you know, I was never a man to person to go ahead and ask for help. And I had this telephone number in my hand that my wife gave me. She left for the meeting with this woman, Patty. And I took the card and I made the phone call. And this is about the second time that I asked for help, about 2 or 3 days. And, you know, once was God in that jail cell, and next was with this man. And I picked up the phone, and I don't remember much about the conversation, but I'm sure we must have made the connection as far as, I'm sure I made the connection with him that he bounced in and out for about 6 or 7 years, and then he found a message, and he did share with me a few promises that, and I'm in my bones, I knew this man was telling me the truth. He shared with me that you never have to drink alcohol ever again. The way you're feeling right now, and by the way, I wasn't feeling too good right about then. He said you never have to feel the way you feel right now. You know, I mean, from now on, ever again, if you choose not to. He also said if you follow some simple rules, some directions, he said, I promise you, you're going to experience some happiness, some joy, and freedom in your life. And if you continue to do these things, follow these simple rules a day at a time for the rest of your life, chances are the best days of your life lay ahead of you. And the men didn't lie. I showed up at his door about a week later after doing an assignment, and I ended up doing an assignment in the doctor's opinion because 4 days, about the following day or a couple of days, was about, I was separated out of the jail cell about 4 days or so, and I was on business down in Richmond, Virginia, which is about 700-800 miles south of New York, and I was afraid to make it down there into Richmond, Virginia to fly because me and airport bars at the time, we didn't get along very well. So I drove in the car, and I just drove. If I had to go to the bathroom, I went in the cup. I wouldn't get out of the car. Fear sobered me a bit. I ended up going directly to the hotel room and checking in and buying the people lunch that were in my office because I wouldn't go out. And I ended up going to a meeting that night. And I remember coming out of the meeting. And I'm 4 days out of the jail cell. And as soon as I came out of the meeting, this obsession to drink came over me. Now, I remember what the judge said a few days earlier. He said, you show up here again, you're gone. No questions asked. You're gone. I remember that. So what came into my mind was, what's wrong with me? And that question has been with me all my life. What's wrong with me? And the only thing that I visualized at that point, after experiencing this obsession that I was going to drink, was that I knew if the cops came, I was gonna go after the gun first, and I was gonna take myself off because I was done. I was experiencing what they were talking about in the doctor's opinion. Some make the supreme sacrifice rather than continue to fight, and I didn't know that at the time, but I was done. With that fear, I shot back to that hotel room and I made a phone call. And I couldn't get in touch with this guy that I talked to a few days earlier because I know this guy had an answer. I just knew it. I just knew it. And I had to get to him. And I left a message on his voicemail and I just told him, I said, I basically shared what I just shared with you. And I just said, if you don't get in touch with me, I'm finished. another cry for help. And I went out of the hotel room. I ran across the street and I got some soft drinks and stuff and just something to try to take away this obsession that I had. And I came back into the hotel room. There was a message there, and it was my wife left a message that she called, letting me know that this guy called her. And I picked up the phone. I called my wife, and my wife asked me, do you have a copy of that big book? And I said, yeah. And she gave me the assignment that he gave her for me. And what it was is to take that doctor's opinion and highlight everything that I can identify with and everything that I think I know and everything that I think is important. But he gave me the prayer, that prayer that we've been sharing on and off over the weekend, that lay aside prayer. And I got on my knees and I said that prayer. And actually, it was two things. My wife told me, she says, he wants you to do three things. The first thing was write out that lay aside prayer. The second thing was do that assignment, the doctor's opinion. And then she hesitated, and I says, well, what's the third thing? And she says, the third thing is if you don't do the first two things, don't even show up at this guy's house because he wants you there on Saturday. So this guy meant business. He meant business. Thank God. And I realized with that that he meant business, and I did that. I began, following some directions, and it wasn't unlike Bill, with Dr. Bob, because once Dr. Bob started to realize, the problem, and I think, at that time with that initial phone call that I had with Larry, the connection was made, okay? And then he started giving me a solution, okay? And he took me on a journey. But I remember that night in that hotel room, only a few hours before I was seriously considering, to take myself off the planet. And after I got finished with that assignment and I got on my knees again and I said that prayer for a second time, I got into that bed that night. And I don't know where this came from, but I knew everything was going to be all right. I didn't know where that came from. And for a guy like me that was battling and fighting with booze for especially those last 7 years, that was a miracle for a guy like me. And I knew something was happening. And the following Saturday, I showed up in this man's house, and he took me on a journey. Big Book Alcoholics Anonymous. And I had amends, and I went back to people, and he shared with me, he told me, he says, it's no different. Trust God, clean house, and help others. And it's been an amazing experience. I can't believe I'm here. And, I know wonderful people from Denmark, from Iceland. Like you said, things happen. Great events are come to pass. And we Peter, on behalf of Peter, his friend Linda, and myself, the hospitality, the fellowship, the friendship, it's been great. We hope to see you again. I was reminded to make a commercial. In April of 2004, Dave P. and Polly P. are going to be doing something here on the 12 traditions as it relates to relationships, I understand. And I'm sure that will be interesting. But I do want to thank you again. And Maybe you can get over to our home group on Staten Island. That's the Away Out group, 6:45 every Sunday night. And we're on fire. When the group started about 7 years ago, it we only had maybe about like 5-6 people, but got big, got small, got big. Now we see on an average of about 50-60 people in that meeting. Like Peter shared throughout the weekend, it was it's people helping people, and that's what we do. That's what we do, and always try to stay in that triangle. God bless. Thank you.